From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The science writer Mary Roach says she wants her latest book about the human digestive tract to inspire people. That's what she says. And it makes sense when you realize how writing has always been a process of exploration for her. She's written about cadavers, about sex, about the intimate details of space travel. But getting people to see digestion as inspiring, she admits, will take some doing, since most of us just see it as disgusting. And that's the reason, outside of academic papers, no one has really written about the human gut. In the book, she points out authors have profiled the brain, the heart, the eyes, our skin, our genitals, even our hair. But she writes, the pie hole and the feed chute are mine. Mary Roach today. Her book is called Gulp. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The science writer Mary Roach is our guest today. Mary's the one who wrote a book about human cadavers and called it Stiff. She wrote about sex, called it Bonk. She's written about the intimate details of space travel, and her latest is called Gulp. It's about as intimate as it gets. It's about the human digestive tract. And like you would expect, she covers the gamut from soup to nuts, from taste to poo. Roach says there's a lot of writing about eating, of course, but not much of it about this end of the process, once that bite ends up in your mouth. In her book, here's how she explains it in a nutshell. We grind and sculpt our food into a moistened bolus that is delivered via a rocket's chorus line of sequential contractions into a self-kneading sack of hydrochloric acid and then dumped into a tubular leach field where it is converted into the most powerful taboo in human history. Today in the program, Mary Roach is joining us to explain what she's discovered about the digestive tract, and we invite you to join us as well. 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. The book is called Gulp, Adventures in the Alimentary Canal, and Mary Roach is the author of five books. I mentioned Stiff and Bonk, and she's joining us today from the studios of NPR in New York City. Mary Roach, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It's really nice to be back.
So it seems like a good part of this book is about the people who explored this stuff that a lot of us think are, you know, certainly in this case, taboo or disgusting. And these scientists and researchers, it seems to interest you that they were able to kind of push forward, you know, get beyond that because of their curiosity. And it seems like you have a connection to these people because you write about in fifth grade, this is where your curiosity seem to kind of move past disgust and fear. Talk about that, if you would.
Sure. In fifth grade, my science teacher, Mrs. Claflin, had one of those wonderful tabletop torsos with the open chest wall where you could take out the parts and you'd put them back in. And I used to occupy my time. My homeroom was Mrs. Claflin's classroom, and so I got to be quite proficient at putting in the pieces. And it was really, you know, the first time I'd thought about my own body as this hull for these strangely shaped and colored objects that were in there doing mysterious things. So I guess that was when my curiosity, you know, the first seed of my curiosity. And I got to be pretty good at that, putting those organs back in the right place. I had no idea what they did. In a sense, it was not a good learning tool because the pieces, you know, the digestive tract is one long tube. You know, it's like a hole from your mouth to the other end. And these pieces came out in chunks, so it was a little misleading in that way. But I still have fond memories of the guy with the removable organs, and I believe he had no head.
Right. You point out there's not a lot of writing about the human gut. Is it because of it's such a taboo? I mean, it's hard to research, I guess, in some ways. Maybe it must be hard to write about because of that part.
It's true. There are books, entire books on the heart, the hands, the brain. Certainly, I've came across once an entire book on hair, human hair, and I have yet to, I mean, there may be, but I have yet to come across a book that focuses on the food chute, basically the human food processor. And it's this remarkable machine that we really, really, really don't want to think about. We love our food, but the minute it crosses our lips, that's it. It doesn't exist anymore. We don't want to talk about it. We don't want to think about it. And even me, I'm pretty immune to to the yuck factor. But when I was working on a chapter about the science of oral processing and what we do with food in our mouths, I tried to focus on myself forming my chewed food into a cylindrical saliva-adhered mass called a bolus. And I tried to pay attention to this process, and I couldn't do it. I kept sort of putting it off. And I'll pay attention to that later.
Yeah.
It's hard to do, even when you want to do it. And I find that the fact it's taboo is a fascinating thing to me, because it is the most basic of processes, taking in food and staying alive. That is what we do, and we really don't want to think about it.
You write about later in the book how really in the beginning of human existence, all we were was a gut. I mean, one researcher told you we were, a highly evolved earthworm surrounding the intestinal tract.
Yeah. This was a gastroenterologist I interviewed in Minneapolis, and he was saying, yeah, in the very beginning, that's what we were. We were this tube, and then at a certain point, in order to reach different food sources, we developed a way to move around, arms and legs in our case, you know, and then you need a brain to, you need a brain to kind of coordinate things. You need a circulatory system to be providing sustenance to those further reaches of the body. So all these other systems come into play. But when you get right down to it, that's the very basic process is bringing in sustenance and processing it and staying alive.
The digestive tract has its own immune system, you point out? Its own kind of primitive
brain.
It's got
its own primitive nervous system.
Yeah. And you say we should be thankful for that. I mean, that our gut evolved like it did. Because you describe the system of a gorilla, for example, how they have to use so much energy digesting. And we don't. We can make reality shows and design computers, stuff like that, right?
Build cathedrals.
Yes.
Exactly. Better ways to wash skyscraper windows and things like that. You think about it. A gorilla or a cow. A cow is got this gigantic fermenter, and it's got to take in order to get all the sustenance it needs. It's got to process a lot of material, and that's really it's a whole day is spent just sort of intaking stuff, material for those bacteria to compost. It's a big composter with a lot of contraction, sort of a mixing paddle built in. I spent an afternoon at UC Davis. The agriculture department has a fistulated cow, which is a cow with a convenient opening in its side, whereby you can put your arm all the way up to the shoulder, wearing a protective glove, shoulder length glove. You can put your arm all the way in. It's this massive holding tank, and there's this. You feel these muscular contractions, and it's hot in there. It is cooking in there, and that's the way the cow processes food. And it's not as streamlined as the way we do it. We have lots of time to do other things other than graze and ferment, and that's a good thing.
Yeah. You. This is a strange way to begin a question, but you had a colonoscopy. After you saw this pair of photographs, and this is something you write about later in the book. But I loved how you wrote about this, because you described this feeling of privilege and humility. Would you talk about that experience? Because I thought that was really kind of lovely.
Sure. Yeah, I had seen it was a one page article in. I'm not sure if it was The Lancet or the New England Journal of Medicine, one of the main medical journals. And someone, probably a gastroenterologist, had a photograph of the sort of doorways between segments of the colon side by side with these archways in one of Gaudi's buildings, La Pedrera, I think it's.
Yeah.
I think it is.
Yeah.
And comparing them side by side and seeing the beauty in the architecture of the human colon. So I thought, well, I want to see my own internal Gaudi. So I marched off to my colonoscopy and requested no sedation, no drugs. And I did really, there's a sensation, there's a kind of a feeling, sort of a mixture of awe and almost just humility that you're in the presence of something that is that amazing and that beautiful and that ignored, you know, the colon, like the human colon. Yeah. And so I have this feeling, you know, from time to time, like when I saw the northern lights and I sort of dropped to my knees. And I wanted this very much to be one of those moments where you see your own inside, your own architecture and the beauty and complexity of it. But in fact, I basically felt mild to moderate cramping.
Right. Well, you begin the book not in the gut, but in the nose. Explain why. Because you call smell, this is one of the doormen of the digestive tract.
Yeah, that's right. Smell is one of, this is the, our first screening mechanism when you're presented with a food or a drink. Smell is, it's a, your nose is a, it's a gas chromatograph. You're taking in these gases, these aromas, and scanning them like good or bad, friend or foe. So this blew me away. I really underestimated the role of the human nose in flavor. I mean, taste is like the shirt and pants.
Right.
It's sweet, salty, bitter, sour, and then umami. Somehow or other, umami got in there. And that's your basics. And everything else that we, you know, cherry, vanilla, lemon, cocoa, chocolate, all the just the almost infinite variety of flavors, that's all happening in the nose. It's these gases that waft up through the back. There's an opening. You have these openings in the back of the mouth and the soft palate, and it goes up into the nasal cavity, and it's red there in the olfactory epithelium. And that is most of our experience of flavor, like 80%. You could practically throw away your tongue and still get a lot of the sensual experience of food, of flavor.
Let's talk about Sue Langstaff. She's what they call a sensory consultant to the beer brewing industry, in fact. And you describe her job as a kind of like sensory forensics. This is how you put it. She reads the stink of things.
Yeah. An industry, beer, wine, olive oil, she's now involved with these days. A company can bring her in and troubleshoot a product. They can basically say, our wine stinks. What went wrong? What is going on? Yeah. She can taste it, sniff it, and detect particular telltale aromas that will lead her to a conclusion about what is wrong in the process. For example, if a beer that has like a hospital smell, that would suggest maybe chlorinated water was used somewhere in the process and it shouldn't have been. Yeah. There's a particularly nasty fustiness to olive oil that smells. The actual descriptors are things like manure, sewer dregs, pig farm waste material. I mean, it's a nasty smell. And that, if she smells that, she knows, okay, you have some sediment in your holding tanks for the olive oil and you need to check for that. So it is this, she's gets these olfactory clues to what went wrong in the making of that product. So she's kind of a smell detective.
Is it a gift that you're born with?
No, it's her. I assumed that these sort of professional noses were born that way.
Yeah.
And she said no. It's she likened it to learning to appreciate music. Initially, you go to a symphony, you just hear the overall sound of the musical piece. And then with time, you can learn to break down, okay, there are the bassoons and here's the, you know, the whatever the French horn, whatever the different components are, you learn to hear those individually. And so your whole experience of that musical piece changes. And it's the same with, say, a wine or an olive oil, where in the beginning, it's just, tastes, it's olive oil.
Yeah.
And over time, you begin to be able to pick out, say, melon or pepper or whatever, you know, whatever it is. And you have a completely different experience. And you can learn it. You don't need to have a more acute nose. You learn it. There are kits for wine, say. Mm-hmm. There's one called Le Nez du Vin. It's the little bottles containing the reference molecules, like the molecules that create the aroma of, say, black cherry, and you get familiar with those individual aromas. And it's almost like learning vocabulary to speak a foreign language. And you just, over time and exposure and practice, you begin to recognize and be able to put words to those aromas. That's something we're not very good at. We're brought up to name things that we see. Yeah. You know, you point to something as a baby and your mom says, yes, a lamp. And you learn words that way and you learn to name what you see. And we don't do that with smell. We don't put names to smell. It's not important in our culture. We're much more visually oriented.
It seems like the takeaway from that chapter, for me anyway, was that most of us as consumers aren't really as discriminating about smells and different qualities as we think we are.
Exactly. Sue Langstaff, the woman I met with, she said that Americans are surprisingly ignorant about olive oil just because we haven't had the kind of exposure Europeans have. So America is consequently a big dumping ground, or has been a big dumping ground, for inferior olive oil because I am testimony to that. I tried out for the University of California at Davis, the Olive Center, was holding tryouts for the olive oil flavor panel. And I gamely tried out and did not make the cut or even come close to making the cut. In fact, at one point, the very basic opening exercise was a bunch of little cups that you were to sniff. And they had things like vanilla and one of them was olive brine, which I absolutely had no idea what it was. But one of them was olive oil, and I was just so proud of myself that I was like, yeah, that's olive oil. That smells really good. And in fact, it was rancid olive oil. And the other people in the room, most of whom were in the olive oil industry, nailed it. They were like, that's rancid olive oil. Yeah. I was ready to get a piece of bread and sop it up.
Right. Taste is the other doorman to the digestive tract. In this chapter you write about I like how you write about how we kind of project our sense of taste and our qualms about taste and food onto our pets. You write a lot about pet tastes. Talk about that.
Yes. Yeah. I was at a company called AFB International that manufactures palatants, which are the flavor coatings for kibble. Right. And these are the coatings that make the dog or cat enjoy the food. If you take away the palatant, there's not much taste there. Yeah. And initially, I was kind of horrified. Oh, this seems really deceitful. They're just spraying the flavor on. And the guy I was talking to, Pat Moeller, his name was, he said, well, I've come from the food industry. I think he was at Frito-Lay. And he said, there are a lot of parallels, you know, between, he said, a Cheeto. You take away that coating on a Cheeto, basically it's like tasteless puffed rice.
Right.
So even a line of microwavable chicken breast entrees, the chicken is designed to be fairly bland so that you put a range of sauces on it and then you have a product line. And so you don't really want the chicken to be contributing taste. You just kind of want it to be a mattress for the sauce, in essence.
Mm. You ask in this section about whether animals with a sense of taste, because some don't. Sperm whales, for example, they pretty much have no sense of taste. That's why there's this. You write about this photograph of all the crap that ended up in sperm whale stomachs.
If you don't have a doorman,
exactly.
Pretty much anything.
Exactly.
Oh, that looks good. I'll try that.
Yeah.
It's a chair.
And you wonder about animals with what it's like to eat without perceiving tastes. And one of the researchers you talked to, Nancy Rossen, says, you know, she mentioned cancer patients, for example, how it's really not pleasant. And in fact, you say that people can actually die of starvation if they don't have this sense of taste.
Yeah, Nancy spoke about patients that she'd talked to whose sense of taste had been destroyed from radiation for cancer treatment.
Yeah.
And she was describing what it's like to take substance into your mouth, not taste it, chew it up, and your body is telling you, this is not food.
Right.
Do not swallow this.
Yeah.
Do not. And you gag and you can't make yourself do it. And it is a terrible problem. I mean, you can manipulate a bit with smell. I mean, the food industry knows that there's sort of this synergy between the two.
Yeah.
For example, if you put into a processed food a smell that we associate with sweet, say vanilla.
Mm-hmm.
You put a lot of that into a food, then smelling that and the association with sweet things, the person will rate something as tasting sweeter. So you can make up for it a bit with flavor, but it's not. And that is done something like with the elderly. You have some degradation in taste, and there's been experiments to try to you know, to amp up the flavor component to make up for shortcomings, and probably vice versa.
Yeah. You write about how the main ingredient in dog food palatants, for example, is liver, because for a for a predator, it's the prey's guts that are the most nutritious part. Though it kind of brings us around to how we Americans turned out to be so squeamish about the food we eat. And you talk about this experience of going to kind of look at the indigenous Inuit people of Canada and how they think about food. And this effort going on, or was going on anyway, among the Inuit to get young people to eat more like their elders, you know, eat traditionally, which meant a lot of stuff from the guts, right?
The scary stuff.
Yeah, the scary stuff.
Yeah, organ meats.
Yeah.
You're right. What you were saying is if you a wild dog, predators in the wild will go right first for the organs, for the entera, the liver, the kidneys, even the stomach and the contents of the stomach can provide more vitamins than you would get from muscle meat. So it is kind of a strange thing that we as Americans want only the least nutritious part of the beast. And I was up in the Canadian Arctic looking into this a bit, and because the Arctic, the tundra is not a place to grow fruits and vegetables. There's really very little that grows up there. There's lichen, there's moss, there's a few little tiny flowers. So you're not going to get your vitamins from fruits and vegetables. You get it from organ meats. And if you look, there was a kit. It was like this was part of the effort to get young Inuit teens to embrace traditional foods. There was a bunch of cutouts of all these different parts that, the caribou bridal veil, which was some stomach membrane. There was blood soup. There was flipper. It was every part of the beast.
Yeah.
And I sat there with some men who they hunt. They would hunt partly to supplement the family diet, and they'd be pointing, going, seal heart raw, I eat that.
Right.
Uh-huh. Caribou brain, yeah, I eat that. They would just went through the whole gamut, and these were the delicacies and they couldn't understand what my problem was when I went to a community feast, and people were like, oh, here, we saved the best part for you. It was an Arctic char, which is a large salmon-like fish. It was a raw eyeball with the connective tissue hanging off the back, kind of looked like a headlamp with the wiring. And they handed it to me with great reverence and like, we saved this for you. You're the guest. And I had to eat it. I mean, it would have been so insulting. They would have thought I was nuts not to eat it. So I found that, it's so much of what we deem food and not food is just culture. Culture.
And we've got a very brief window of opportunity, I guess, if you want kids to be discriminating eaters. Because you talk about how human infants, we pretty much enter the world without any information about what we could and should and shouldn't eat, I guess. But by the time we're 10, everything's kind of fixed. So there's a window, I guess.
Yeah, we do. There was a researcher at University of Pennsylvania, Paul Rosen, a psychologist, who did these wonderful experiments some years back, looking at what age does the cultural sense of what is good to eat and what is disgusting, when does that kick in? And he had this one study, it was kids 16 to 29 months, and in that range, they'd eat pretty much, they would try pretty much anything.
Yeah.
He put in front of them ranging from a sterilized dead grasshopper, a cookie with ketchup on it, some fish eggs, artificial dog turd, which had been fashioned from peanut butter, and I just imagine one of his undergraduates got the task of making the fake dog poop. They had the Limburger cheese for smell. I mean, it was apparently quite high fidelity artificial dog turd, and put it in front of the kids saying dog do, and the kids happily tucked into it. They had no sense of, oh, that's disgusting. The one thing that they wouldn't go near, I think maybe only it was 15% of the kids would try it, was a human hair. That was just too non-food-like in its appearance, I think.
Mm. So you write about how it's different in cultures, the way we think about, the things we eat, the things we won't eat. But you say the most effective agent of dietary change is the adulated eater, the king who embraces whelks, you say, the revolutionary hero who has a passion for skewered hearts. So how does that play out these days? With celebrity chefs, fancy restaurants, stuff like that?
Yes, very much. I mean, when I was working on the book, there was an Iron Chef episode called Battle Offal. And they were preparing. One guy was preparing coxcomb, the little spiky thing on the rooster. Mm. They were every imaginable organ meat was in there in the mix. And then they had these respected people in the food industry sitting down, tasting it and swooning about it and how delicious it was. And there are restaurants now. Animal is a famous one. There's one in London. I'm forgetting the name. There's three or four. There's one in the Bay Area, Encanto. Mm-hmm. And these are – so you sit down and here's a menu with things that 25 years ago would have seemed alarming. And you would have run from the room. But now it's trendy. It's – and that's not a – I'm not saying that's a bad thing.
No.
I think it's great. I think because some of these, they're incredibly flavorful. They're not just good for you. They're often really flavorful. Yeah. I mean, fat, bone, blood, anytime you've got that in the mix, it's going to amp up the flavor.
I know here in Salt Lake, there's a really terrific restaurant where bone marrow has become incredibly popular.
Bone marrow. This is one of the – there was a great study. I know you didn't ask me this, but I'm throwing it in there.
Good.
There was this study of – Clara Davis, this woman who did this amazing, she was children at an orphanage, and she gave them just this smorgasbord of ingredients, just like vegetables, meats, basics. Nothing was processed or prepared. It was just the goods right there. And the kids would, they were left to their own devices. There was nothing sweet or processed. It was all good stuff. But one of the most popular items was bone marrow.
Wow.
These kids were like, "Yeah, bring it on, bone marrow," and bone marrow is, very. I'm a little uncomfortable with. But I tried caribou bone marrow up in the Arctic. I couldn't embrace it the way I wanted to.
But you ate the eyeball.
I ate the eyeball. I ate muktuk, which was narwhal skin, which was delicious. Very kind of a mushroomy, nutty flavor and kind of a snail-like, rubbery texture, but wonderfully delicious and subtle, yeah.
Mary,
and terribly politically incorrect.
Right. Mary Roach is with us. Her new book is called Gulp, Adventures in the Alimentary Canal. And we invite you to join us if you have questions or comments. 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@KUER.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the science writer Mary Roach is with us to talk about the human digestive tract. It's the subject of her latest book. Once you swallow something, there begins this extraordinary process. And Mary Roach explores the science and the stories of the digestive tract, the taste, the smell, the contractions, and the acid all ending up, well, you know how it ends up. The book is called Gulp, Adventures in the Alimentary Canal, and she's joining us from the studios of NPR in New York City. So one thing that's great about the book are the stories, not just of the researchers themselves, because there's a lot of that, the character, the personalities of the researchers who are studying all of this, but also some of these characters from history. Let's talk about Horace Fletcher, the economic nutritionist, because he starts this very strange fad of really thorough chewing.
Really, really, really thorough chewing. Yeah. Horace Fletcher was an efficiency buff.
Yeah.
You go to his papers at Harvard, and he's typed them on very thin onion skin paper, and it's both sides it's typed on, and the margins are tiny. The man did not want to waste anything, any paper, anything at all. And it carried over to his theory of chewing. He had this, it was called Fletcherizing.
Yeah.
And Fletcherizing, you would chew the food till it liquefied in your mouth. And sometimes that took as many as 722 chews. This was for a fifth of an ounce of a shallot, a bite of shallot. And I did the math on this, and mealtimes would be in the hours. You definitely would not be able to hold down a job. Horace Fletcher had money. He was wealthy and didn't need to hold down a job, which is good because the Fletcherizing would have made that pretty difficult. But Fletcher was a very charismatic man. He had friends in high places, and including scientists, and he won people over for some time, to the point where there was almost a proclamation that Fletcherizing would be part of the National Health Plan, and the military was considering, at a certain point, they actually had Fletcherizing in their health and hygiene manuals. This was something that the troops were supposed to do, and of course, it was thought, his belief was that if you chewed it really, really, really thoroughly, you would extract half to two-thirds, again, the nutrients and calories from the food. So if you're the person who is cooking for a large number of troops, this was very appealing because you could cut the budget costs down considerably. And he took that quite a ways. It was a huge fad, Fletcherizing. Franz Kafka apparently was a Fletcherizer, and this has really undone my – you know, I have this image of Franz Kafka that everybody has, the very stern-looking young man with the wonderful cheekbones, and now I'm picturing him with this
chewing
just
away.
Grimly chewing away and at the breakfast table, yeah.
You tell the story. It does make you wonder what this does – how chewing like this – what it does in the digestive tract. Because you tell this one story of a practitioner of Fletcherizing who produced, as far as I could tell, they produced the equivalent of these kind of rabbit pellets in the way of poo.
Yeah, this was another matter of great pride to Horace Fletcher was that you would, because you were supposedly absorbing every last bit of your food, you would only need to empty the system, as it were, once every 8 days or so, and it would be this cleanly, non-smelly, dry thing that you could hold in the palm of your hand without staining your skin. And he kept some specimens that he was particularly proud of. He had them sort of on a shelf in the kitchen. He was very, very, very into getting his output down such that nothing was wasted. Nothing was to be wasted. And there are people now that are adherents of thorough chewing. And there's nothing wrong with thorough chewing, but it's kind of an insult to the human stomach, which is very, very effective at reducing what you put in it to liquid.
Yeah.
With the exception of, you know, peanuts, corn, raw meat, some of those will make their way along without being thoroughly broken down. So by all means, chew those up thoroughly and you'll extract a little more fat from the peanuts, maybe a little more nutrition from the meat. But the stomach is so effective at reducing food to chyme, which is that sort of slurry that's passed on to the small intestine. So it's not – if you didn't have a stomach, yeah, I think Fletcherizing makes some sense. But otherwise, probably not worth the time invested.
Before we had computerized models of the human gut, there was a human model, Alexis St. Martin. He's this former trapper you write about. This is in the 1800s. He'd been accidentally shot in the side. His wound healed in such a way that it was kind of like a fistula, I guess, right? Like a window into his digestive tract.
Yes, that's right. Very much like the fistulated cow at the agriculture school. It heals with an opening, in this case a gastrocutaneous fistula, I think you would call it. Anyway, it healed up such that you could open this little window and look inside and see digestion in action. And Beaumont, William Beaumont, the surgeon who treated this young man, saw the potential for a series of experiments on human digestion. He became fascinated, obsessed, you might say, with the human gastric juices. He published a lengthy book on experiments and observations on the gastric juices. And you would put different foods in mesh bags and place them on a string in the stomach of Alexis St. Martin and then leave them there for different time intervals, pull them back out, see what was going on. He would take gastric juice out of the body to see, will this process happen without the vital forces of the body? Can it happen on its own? What is this substance? What kind of acid is it? What is it? Does it work in different temperatures? So there's this lengthy series of experiments that you admire his scientific spirit and his creativity that went into this, but you can't help but wonder what Alexis St. Martin made of it all. He took off a few times, Alexis St. Martin. He was paid, but it was a very interesting kind of back and forth, kind of a mutual dependence that spanned 30 years.
Yeah.
And Alexis St. Martin eventually got the upper hand. He took off, and in the end, they came after his when he died, people came after his William Osler, I think it was, wanted the stomach for some cabinet of curiosity, some medical museum. And the family of Alexis St. Martin sent a telegraph saying, do not come for autopsy, will be killed.
Right.
I was thinking, like, if I were the telegraph operator, wow, that's a weird one.
I love this story, though, because you talk about how more than anything, it's one of obsession. And it's and it seems like this is something that's really interesting to you. This, you know, Beaumont, he didn't treat St. Martin very well. It was pretty disrespectful of him. And, you know, he figured St. Martin should kind of know his place and, you know, he mm-hmm. imposed himself upon him. But you talk about, but it seems like this idea of obsession is something you really are fascinated by.
Well, I am fascinated by it. I love the way that some people become so interested in something that it kind of takes over their ability to see the world in its proper perspective kind of drops away. There was a Beaumont, when his book came out, he was deeply hurt and puzzled by the fact that this was not a bestseller, that he was having difficulty selling the book. This is the book on experiments and observations in the gastric juice. And he just, he was sending it to the vice president at the time, the treasury, admirals, because he was pretty well connected by the end of his, by the time the book came out. He would send this book out expecting people to go, oh my God, I read it cover to cover.
Right.
Fascinating book. He couldn't understand why the rest of the world wasn't as interested in gastric juice as he was. And I think he also expected Alexis St. Martin to understand why it was so important to spend years and years and years studying this stuff in the stomach. And Alexis St. Martin's like, whatever, give me a check.
Right.
It was so. And I encountered modern day researchers as well. And I love the dedication, but also the enthusiasm. I spent time in the Netherlands with Erica Saletti, who's a saliva researcher. This is a beautiful Italian woman, young woman, and she's got this infectious enthusiasm for spit.
Yeah. I mean,
it's very impressive and miraculous substance. I won't bore you with it because I've got a bit of the geeky obsessive bug now. I won't bore you with all the miraculous things that saliva does, but just sitting with her, and at one point, you know, she slaps the desk. She goes, it happens so fast, it's so incredible. And sometimes even when these proteins are broken down, they're equally effective. It's a miracle. she had so much, and I don't mean it to sound like dorky, or it was just to allow yourself to be bowled over by the miracle of something that exists in everybody's mouth, to be so won over by it that you lose your inhibitions and you talk to strangers about the miracle of saliva.
Yeah.
And here I am now. I've been infected. I'm going around on the radio talking about the miraculous properties of human spit.
Did you ever – I did make me wonder if – it seems like there was kind of a – might be a book in there. Did you ever think of a book called Spit?
I think – you know, the saliva chapter may be the longest chapter.
I know.
In the
you
book.
Love it.
I think we're done now with Spit. I think that's it. It was a nice ride, but I think we're done.
I'll tell you what I loved about it. The taboo about saliva is really interesting because Saletti really sort of takes you through the two kinds of spit, you know, the unstimulated and the stimulated saliva, and we don't need to get into that. But most of us find saliva pretty disgusting when it's outside of our own mouths. And in the book, you raise this question about that boundary, you know, where is that boundary between, as you put it, self and non-self, or a psychologist put it that way,
right?
Which is really – say something about that, because I think that's really the most interesting part for me about spit almost.
Yeah, it is this saliva – well, all of the body products, when you get right down to it, blood, semen, saliva, they're all we when they're inside our bodies, we have no problem with them. We don't find them upsetting in any way. We depend upon them. We want them. Yeah. But as soon as they leave the body – and saliva, I think, is – I guess tears would be an exception. Mm. But saliva, the moment it's outside the body, becomes an object of near universal revulsion.
Right.
There was a study – again, Paul Rosen, the University of Pennsylvania psychologist, did a study where he had people imagine your favorite bowl of soup. And how likely are you to – or tell me, you know, what is the rating of how likely you are to enjoy it? And you know, of course, people had 9 or 10. And then he said, okay, now imagine spitting into that bowl of soup. And now how likely are you to enjoy that bowl of soup, and it went down practically to zero. Even though it's your own saliva, even though it's going to be mixing with the soup in your mouth, when it crosses the boundary. And it's interesting to look at. He looked at the micro anatomy of the self. Like, for example, you have food on your tongue. Mm-hmm. Now, when you stick it out of your mouth, does it now become an object of revulsion? No, it's not. You have to extend past the lips to the distance that the tongue will go from the mouth, and that's still okay. But once it leaves the body, it's an object of revulsion. The exception being, we kind of extend the boundaries of the self to our loved ones, our children, our lovers. We don't have a problem with their saliva. With the case of babies, frequently a parent doesn't feel the same revulsion toward their body products that they would any other human being. So it's almost a philosophical matter.
Mary Roach is with us. Her new book is called Gulp: Adventures in the Alimentary Canal. And we need to take another brief break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Mary Roach. We're talking about her new book. It's called Gulp: Adventures in the Alimentary Canal. She's joining us from the studios of NPR in New York City. So you went to this museum in Philadelphia to see this preserved colon of a man named J.W. This was a mega colon, which will eventually lead us in the story to Elvis Presley. But talk about that.
It's an extraordinary specimen. It's the Mütter Museum is, first of all, just a wonderful. It's a kind of a modern day cabinet of curiosities, medical curiosities, and specimens and. A wonderful place to take certain children. It's not everybody's cup of tea, but for those whose cup of tea it is, there's just no place like the Mütter Museum, and I'm one of those people. But the showpiece there, to my mind, is this. It's this glass vitrine in the middle of one of the exhibit rooms, and it's got the beautiful museum lighting, the curatorial lighting, and there's this beautiful case, and inside is this massive colon. It is in diameter. It's the same as my waist. Yeah. It's as big around as my waist. I'm a fairly slender woman. It's 28 inches around, and it's not normal. It's a genetic condition where the final stretch of the colon doesn't have the nerves laid down, so that the contractions that normally push things through are made very, very difficult. Things tend to back up. The organ stretches out. It loses its ability to contract and to be helpful and to push things along. And terrible cases of constipation develop.
Yeah.
And more direly, the effort to empty oneself can create straining that, in the case of J.W. and also Elvis, created a lethal heart arrhythmia.
Yeah. It did.
There's a syndrome called defecation-associated sudden death, where you're pushing so hard, you go into this Valsalva maneuver, you get wild seesawing of the heart rate and blood pressure, and your body tries to stabilize, and you can end up with this arrhythmia that can be fatal. It's very, very rare. It's enough of a concern, though, that in ICU units, heart patients are, and using a bedpan is a particularly difficult way to evacuate one's bowels. So those folks are on stool softeners in the ICU if the heart patients frequently. So I interviewed Elvis's doctor, Dr. Nick Nikopoulos. And although he was implicated, and there was a back and forth about what was it—the prescription drugs that killed him, or what was it? On the death record, it's a fatal heart arrhythmia, and there's no argument over the. There's a description of what his colon looked like during the autopsy, and it was quite distorted and blocked, and you really had to feel bad for him.
Yeah, I mean, and this you write about how constipation, you say, pretty much ran his life, and it runs the lives of a number of people. And one of the things you write about is these remedies throughout history. One of them, this English physician named Thomas Sydenham, I think it is, which he has this process that included keeping a live kitten on the naked belly.
And I have no idea why. My guess is that it was a placebo. It was just something nice and soothing that would distract you and make you think that it was helping, and that in time the blockage would pass. Because frequently intestinal blockages resolve on their own. But the kitten, I don't know. There were some curious strategies for what was called obstipation, as in obstinate constipation. Obstipation used to be treated kind of similar to if you have clogged pipes in your home. There was the you could either snake it or plunge it. So they would use, you know, forceful syringes of water, or they would put lead shot or mercury in to kind of break it up and move along. That was an unusual way to do it. There was one physician who advocated just putting your hand up there and pulling it out.
Yeah.
I'm sorry if people are eating.
Well,
but anyway, Thomas Sydenham's his approach was certainly more humane. I don't know how effective it was, but it was lovely to picture.
What it did raise this question of all of the myths that seem associated with the colon. There's one Scottish surgeon who figured it was a pretty much useless structure, that it was a serious defect in human anatomy. And there's later in the book where you also write about this myth related to the human colon, you know, that it's full of disease and it's dirty, and this is why we have all these products that try to cleanse our colon. But it seems like we don't know what the colon does.
There was a huge fad in the turn of the last century for auto-intoxication was what people feared was happening. In other words, feces is smelly and dirty and we don't like it, so we assume it must be bad for us to have it in us. So consequently, to get rid of it as soon as possible must be healthy. So there were these devices like the Joy Beauty Life Cascade, which was basically like a whoopee cushion with a nozzle in the middle, and you would sit on it and your body weight would force the water up. It was a do-it-yourself simple sit-upon enema.
Yeah.
Hugely successful. Sold for decades, this Joy Beauty Life Cascade. And a lot of enema kits. There was a lot of laxative products that were sold for this purpose, just on the philosophy that the sooner it's out of your body, the better.
Yeah.
So just sort of encouraging diarrhea. And not based on any solid scientific evidence, but just this intuition that feces is dirty and smelly and it must be bad for us. And it's not. It's not. I mean, that's not. Then I could go in. There were some studies that were quite interesting that we don't have time to go into here. But trust me, it's gross, but it's not poison.
Yeah.
We've evolved to take care of waste in a pretty efficient way, and it works pretty well. And we don't need to be to cut out. There was a surgeon who was cutting out the colon to speed things up, just sort of connecting the small intestine to the rectum. Like, wow, that'll speed it up.
Let's talk about Michael Levitt. Michael Levitt is a scientist who studies. Well, he studies a lot of things, but as he himself pointed out, his study in flatulence has pretty much overshadowed everything else he does.
Well, not just one. I think, by my count, 34 studies on human flatulence.
Right.
And yes, it was many, many years ago that he did these studies, and he, in the interim, has done a lot of other work, and he feels like, oh, God, you want to talk about that?
Yeah.
You know, I went to visit him, and, you know, he one of the things that he did when he was studying human flatulence, he created a, because you have to trap the gas to study it. So he came up with these mylar pantaloons. That's his word for them. Sort of a, looks like tinfoil knickers. And I wanted to see those. I just was very curious as to what they look like. But we sat down and he was talking about the work he had done in intestinal stirring, which is the small intestine has these little finger-like projections that stir up the material in there and they improve nutrient absorption. He talked about, there are a number of important things that he'd done. And I sort of listened patiently till I felt that it was appropriate to say, can I see the mylar pantaloons?
Do we all have a distinctive flatus smell? I mean, you know, is it distinctive for each and every one? I suppose it is.
I'm going to quote Alan Kligerman, who ran the Kligerman Digestive Disease Center, which is affiliated with the product Beano. He said to me when I visited, a gas smell is as characteristic as a human fingerprint. So everybody's got their own unique aroma, bouquet. Yeah. Depends on what you're eating, depends on what flora, what bacteria you have in your colon. And so you do, and it, of course, fluctuates day by day. But yeah, everybody's got their own special smell.
Yeah. Let me ask you this finally. Because you asked this question in the book, does distaste over certain subjects slow our progress in treating certain diseases, for example? You know, there's this taboo about, about feces, about the rectum, you know, stuff like anal cancer, mm-hmm. for example. What do you think? Do you think that it's keeping us from talking about things, studying things?
I think that it does to a certain extent. Anal cancer for a long time didn't have an advocacy group. It didn't have its own colored ribbon. The people who founded it were lamenting how difficult it was because people don't feel comfortable talking about it. The same applies to something that's been in the news a lot more these days, fecal transplants, which are extremely effective.
Yeah.
They're cheap. It doesn't cost anything to, there's nothing to buy. It's some donor's feces that is being used. And it's being used to cure chronic C. difficile infection, which kills people. Yeah. And it's 30,000 people a year die from it. And this is a cure that's it's something the first one was done back in the 80s. And it's something that it's kind of amazing it's taken this long. There's other reasons as well. It's, how do you bill for it?
Yeah.
If it's, if it's not a pharmaceutical product, who's going to pay for the testing? So there's that, too. But I do think that a reluctance to talk about it is going to slow down research. In the early days of anatomy, the early dissectors, they'd throw away the colon because of its nastiness and scent bag propensities was the quote that I read. That was just, let's just get rid of that. It stinks. So nobody really looked at it for a while.
Yeah. Mary Roach. Her book is called Gulp, Adventures in the Alimentary Canal. She joined us from the studios of NPR New York City. Mary, thanks very much.
Thank you so much for having me on, Doug.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Lane Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.